Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. I'm Steve Woodward. My co-host, David Hensley, is away. But we are delighted to bring you a really special show this morning, which will allow us to spend the entire hour with a Pinehurst resident named Robert A. Neff. And we'll talk a little bit about Mr. Neff in a moment. But I do not want to overlook our revered and wonderful sponsor of this program, The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, since 1980. Your go-to for breakfast and lunch each and every day, and also your source for all kinds of catering services for small office get-togethers or the wedding of the century. And they're over there right off of Highway 211 outside of Pinehurst. The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. Thanks to Luke and his wonderful staff there. And we appreciate their support of this program. Robert A. Neff has been residing in Pinehurst since about 2008. And in his 80s, he grew... a little anxious for wanting some things to do. After having studied engineering and political science and earning a law degree at Cornell University, joining the U.S. Air Force when it was in its infancy as a JAG officer, and then finding a job with Rockefeller Brothers International, which is, in fact, the Rockefellers that we're all familiar with, His work for the Rockefeller Brothers took him all over the world. To say that he's traveled the world is an understatement. To say that Mr. Neff has encountered fascinating and consequential people in his life is an understatement. And to say that that he is anything other than extraordinary only begins to describe him. At one point, he was the director and an officer with one of the first major all-cargo airlines in the world, which was called Seaboard World Airlines. And we'll talk a little bit later in the program with him about that venture. When he does allow himself any spare time, he plays a grand piano. He's a jazz pianist, as if you couldn't add anything more to this fascinating resume. And then, of course, he has written two published books. A third is in the wings, waiting to be published. In his first, he interweaves history and imagination in a novel based around World War II that challenges preconceptions of those who waged it and those who watched it happen. And that is Uber Alles, a wonderful work of fiction, which I highly recommend. And we will be spending the next roughly hour talking with Mr. Neff.
My pleasure to be here, Steve.
In this community of Southern Moore County, and specifically Pinehurst, it has been my experience, having lived here now the better part of a decade, that there are many fascinating individuals among us. And one of them is Robert A. Neff, who I had the privilege of meeting a couple of years ago. Learning about a book that he had authored from a mutual friend of ours. And we'll get into that that chapter, pun intended, of his career in a moment. But Robert Neff has been a resident here in Pinehurst for nearly 20 years. And after a long and multifaceted career, taking him around the world, and that's not an exaggeration. But let's talk a little bit about, I think, the sort of centerpiece of your adult professional life was spent working for a family business that's well known to pretty much any American. That would be the Rockefeller family. Graduated from Cornell University and then became a U.S. Air Force JAG officer. And coming out of college, you had some choices to make. Tell us a little bit about what led you to the Rockefeller orbit and how that sort of evolved into a very defining part of your life.
Well, as most of the things that you remember, there's an element of good luck involved. And I started out going to engineering school at Cornell. And Cornell being at least at that time in the 1940s and 50s, a very advanced university, they did not want their engineers just going around with a slide rule hooked to their hip and being nerds. So we were required to take two courses each term outside the engineering school. And the engineering curriculum was a five-year curriculum rather than a four to allow for those extra two courses. And I took all of mine in the department, which was called the government department at that time. It was really sort of a pre-law. And Cornell was also a school that had received a land grant in order to finance itself. Abraham Lincoln started that. I can't go that far back in my explanation, but at any rate, Cornell decided you had to take ROTC if you were healthy enough to stand up, which I was. So I had been commissioned in the Army as an undergraduate engineer. I still had a year to go, and I was talked into double registering and going to the law school, which the Army was, they were a little bit hesitant to do, but right at that time, the Air Force was created, and every student in the whole ROTC program went to a place called Barton Hall, probably 3,000 of us. We were asked to count off by fours. I was a four, and they said, you fours are now in the Air Force.
And just for context, tell us what year this was.
That would have been 1953.
Okay.
1952 or three. And it was 52, I'm sorry. And you're now in the Air Force, and as Air Force people, you got to learn something totally different. Don't make any plans for this summer. You're going to go to Air Force summer camp, and you're going to learn all the things of polar navigation that we don't teach to guys in the Army. They had just created the Air Force. It didn't exist as a separate service previously. So everything was first instance, and I was assigned to go to O'Hare Field. O'Hare Field was a Boeing assembly location that had been called a field because a fellow named Butch O'Hare had been killed in the war. His father was Al Capone's lawyer, very powerful man in Chicago, and as I think a well-earned tribute, they had named this base out in Park Ridge, O'Hare Field. I went to O'Hare Field. That summer...
Today, one of the busiest airports in the world.
Yes. Yeah. Probably second to Atlanta's. At any rate, That year, a strange thing happened. You being a politically involved guy might know this. Both political conventions were held in Chicago, 10 days apart, in the same facility. And it was the same time that they had ever been televised. And my roommate's father was the head of the local television station there. So I didn't get a lot of Air Force training, but I got a lot of exposure to politics that summer. And as a result of that, it stayed a part of what I was doing. Now, go back to when I'm in law school. I was earning a little extra money playing the piano. I had a tuxedo, which qualified me for all sorts of things I didn't intend to do, one of which was a very prominent member of the Cornell Law School and his wife, William Rogers and Adele Rogers, were both in Washington. He was one of the undersecretaries in the Department of Justice, and he was about to become the Attorney General of the United States. And so the chairman of the board of the university and various luminaries, and somebody had to go from the law school senior class. And I had the tuxedo. So I went to Washington for this nice celebration of Bill Rogers and Adele Rogers. And I sat next to a gentleman who looked at me and kind of recognized me. And I recognized him because he used to come up in his own railroad car for football games and things and have parties. And we had belonged to the same fraternity. And he said, what are you going to do after law school? Because I'm doing something new and interesting. And I said, I am overdue to go in my military service. I've got a temporary restraint on that, but I'm going to have to go within a week of the time I take the bar into the military. And he said, well, keep in touch, at which point he turned to Henry Kissinger on his left, and I turned to somebody that I don't remember at all on my right, and that was the end of it. But I did take him up on that, and I started writing to him every month. His name was Robert Purcell. He was the man who really started the mutual fund industry in the United States, and he had been hired by the Rockefeller family to run Rockefeller Brothers, Inc. There are five brothers and a sister who have all of their non-eleemosynary things sort of incorporated together, and they were managed up to that point by Brother Nelson Rockefeller, who at that time decided he wanted to be a politician, and he stepped away from that job. And the other four brothers all had something else they were doing, and they went out and they recruited this Robert Purcell to head something called International Basic Economy. And it was all the things that they were planting around the world. Remember, we're in the post-World War II era, and we have a lot of technology and a lot of new developments that others want in Europe and South America. So I wrote to Mr. Purcell every month wherever I was being a JAG officer, and I was all over the world, literally. And his next mistake was he answered me. And so the day that I got discharged, I drove to 30 Rock Plaza and said, Mr. Purcell, do you remember me? And, of course, somebody had come in and told him that I was standing out there, and he remembered me and had one of my letters there. And we sat down and talked. And he kept looking at his watch, and he said, okay, I've got another appointment. But he said, see this pile? And he had a pile of things on his desk. He said, why don't you take that home tonight and come in and tell me what's in there tomorrow? I did that for the next 2 weeks. I cleaned his desk immaculately of all the things he was working on, at the end of which time he said, would you like to be my assistant? And you remember the old joke, would I, would I? Mm-hmm. I was sort of in the would I. And I went to work for him and worked right out of the family offices at 30 Rockefeller Center. The floors 51 through 56 were all occupied by family and family enterprises, and they were spread all over the world. And I still had a tuxedo, and you know, the first thing I began doing was going and reporting on various things and places. So that connection started me on a series of jobs, locations that lasted until 1980. So we're talking 1958 till 1980. In one area or another, I was connected with things that they were doing. It's a long answer to a short question.
No, that and what a great, I mean, what a great, you know, sort of case of, you know, meeting the right people at the right time, and also demonstrating that persistence does have its virtues, because that certainly opened the door for you. So working within the Rockefeller family, one of the really interesting things I remember you talking about the last time we spoke was your foray into chicken farming, I believe it is. Now that's a long way from the sophistication of Rockefeller Center in Midtown Manhattan.
It surely is. To lead you into why I was interested in chickens, you have to go back to probably 1939 when I was 8 years old. I was dared by somebody to steal some colored chicks out of the window of the local feed store at Easter time. I don't know if you remember when they used to dye little four-day-old chicks different colors, and they would wander around. There would be a blue one and a green one and all that.
Well, probably a now banned practice.
But. I think so. But somehow eight of them managed to jump into the pockets of my raincoat, and I took them home and dumped them on the back lawn and enjoyed having these colored chicks there until my dad came home from work. And he said, "Where did you get the chicks?" And I said, "They followed me home from Bubby Dilk's feed store." And he said, "Well, you've got to do something to atone for that. You can either go back and tell Bubby Dilk's that you stole chicks from him and pay him whatever he tells you you owe him. I think it was probably 10 cents each. Or you can go back and buy some chicken feed and some wire." Well, the second one was much less heinous for me. I went back and got some wire and put it on the lawn, and my eight little chicks all survived, and they grew up to be pullets, and I kind of liked that. And for my birthday, my dad got me a dozen New Hampshire Reds, and by the time I got to the end of the year, I had six dozen New Hampshire Reds and an old shack from his oil refinery that I turned into a poultry shack, and a big fence around in an area. And I was selling chickens, and I was trading older chickens that don't lay anymore. I couldn't chop them up, but I could trade them with a lady named Ruth Pierce, who raised the little piglets. And now you got to realize we're getting into the war years at this point, and having eggs and chickens and little piglets that were smoked and everything was a business.
Yeah. Now, and you were just a kid.
I was just a kid. Yeah. Well, kids did different things at that time.
Yeah.
Now going forward, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller, who everybody kind of remembers for some things, but he was a great advocate of the United States involvement in Latin America. And long before I had a job in that office, he had gone down to Venezuela and Argentina, and he had cattle farms there. And he saw the possibilities of starting various businesses and wanted to have supermarkets. And in Venezuela particularly, he wanted to have poultry. They were importing chickens. They had all that oil money. They were importing eggs. They were importing milk. My first assignment was to go down and evaluate in various countries the things that were down there. And when I got to Colombia, very interesting country, where they were well-connected, I saw that everybody ate beef three times a day. And if you were a really special person, they invited you to dinner on Sunday and they brought out the most god-awful chicken you'd ever had, the kind of red stringy thing that they chased under the house and chopped the head off that morning. And I went back and I said, they sell these chickens for five times what they sell really good prime beef for in Colombia. And as a treat, people have poultry. We ought to have a chicken farm here. I told that to my friend, Mr. Purcell. And he said, well, Bob, we'll help you out if you want to do that. He did not remember or didn't know that Nelson had tried to do that in Venezuela and gotten Newcastle disease and wiped out about 100,000 birds overnight. And that was a no-no for anybody. But he said, I'm going to support you in that, and got me in touch with the right people around the world. And we brought in incubators from over in Europe, and we brought in white leghorns from Glastonbury Farms in the United States. And pretty soon, we had a poultry farm outside of Medellin that was turning out about 45,000 birds a week and selling them, which almost took over the entire market for poultry in the country. And I learned one valuable lesson from this that I suppose I knew, but I hadn't experienced. And that is, when you have tremendous success doing something, it can't necessarily be transferred someplace else. And that poultry operation absolutely took over the economy of the nation that it was in. And so there was a tendency to go and start chicken farming in various other places, about half of which were as good as the ones had been in Venezuela. They didn't work, but some of them worked a lot. But the Avícola Colombiana Limitada became the biggest poultry farm anywhere in Latin America, and I enjoyed it a lot. I've always liked chickens ever since. When I walk by some, I talk to them. And my wife kind of looks crazy at me. But
so that, what period of time did that encompass in your working life, the chickens?
About 5 to 6 years, mm-hmm. from 1960 until the middle of the 1960s. But the other thing that I did in Colombia that had never been anywhere before was Mr. Purcell, as I mentioned to you, started Investors Diversified Services, which was the first real big mutual fund family. And I know my friend Jack Bogle would disagree with me if he were here, but we started a mutual fund in Colombia and then went on and did one in Chile. It did one in Argentina, and did one in Brazil, and they were all very successful, and eventually became part of the banking system down there. But trying to talk somebody into buying a share in something that he could see was an adventure in itself.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was. Well, we all sort of think of mutual funds as having always existed in one form or another, but obviously that was an industry that came into its own not terribly long ago.
Well, the idea from the standpoint of the people I was working for was to find avenues into creating a middle class. And there were no lack of good companies in let's stay with Colombia for a moment. There were probably 40 or 50 very good companies, and people knew their names, but there was no way they could buy any stock in them. They didn't know anything about the bolsa. And this gave them an opportunity to buy a package. Mm-hmm. And they still didn't believe it. You normally, when you went into a small city and wanted to talk about this, you had to have the head of the church there, because his presence would indicate that you were acceptable, you weren't there to steal their money. Mm-hmm. And we did guarantee people could get their money back. They would still have paid their commission to get in, but lots of people would come back the second week and see if they'd get their money back and then put it back in again. But it became a very popular form of participation in lots of companies. It funded a lot of companies beyond where they had been. And I thought it was a really good thing to be doing from the standpoint of my owners who wanted to make some money through this operation, but the people that we sold it to and the country, of course.
Yeah. A reminder, our guest this morning is Robert A. Neff, a resident here in Pinehurst, attorney, a commercial business developer, and author. And also, at one point, in the airline industry as well. And before we get to that story about flight, I seem to recall you telling me about a helicopter ride from London into the countryside.
Oh, geez.
And landing in someone's yard.
Yeah.
And that someone happened to be a rather well-known person. Do you remember that story?
I remember the story. I remember the event. I'm not sure your listeners would find it that interesting.
I think it's fascinating.
Well, by virtue of some things you may or may not get into, I ended up working for Lawrence Rockefeller, who had put a lot of capital into the airline industry. And I had done a couple of little jobs for him. And he put some big money into something called Seaboard and Western Airlines, which was an all-cargo line that had been founded by the Norden brothers right after World War II. It gave me an opportunity to come back to New York. But then swiftly, for a reason that's much too complex for our conversation, I ended up with a subsidiary airline operating out of Gatwick Airport in the UK. So I had an office in London and one at Kennedy Airport. And I was a single parent of two little boys trying to operate a house and two airlines. But the gentleman who took over the titular head of that small airline over in London, it was what was called an E-license airplane that was licensed to fly between Gatwick and points in Africa. And that's a whole story unto itself. But this gentleman, his name was Charles Houston, and he was knighted. Charles Houston was married to a successful British actress during the World War II era. Florence Desmond was her name. And he made life easy for me. He gave me a nice house to live in London. And picked me up when I flew over there, and I'd stay for 5 or 6 days and go back. And he would even let me bring my kids along and had somebody to sit with them. But then one day he said, would you like to come out to my house in Surrey? And I said, absolutely. And Desi said, yes, come out for the weekend. So I went out there. Well, this man lived like the movie Tom Jones, if you remember, living out in the countryside with this beautiful rolling grass and cattle and horses and all that. And he said, I knew that Charles also was a helicopter operator. He had his own. He said, let's take the chopper and go out and fly around. And we did. We flew around over, I don't know what the acreage might have been, but it seemed like a lot of territory. And he said, I'm going to drop in on my neighbor. And I looked down, and I saw this house there. It was not inconsequential. We sat right down outside the dining room window, and I remembered I had seen it on the cover of Fortune magazine. So I said, that's John Paul Getty's house. And he said, yes, he's my neighbor and friend. At which point, he came busting out and welcomed us. And I learned that Mr. Getty was terrified of flying. He would only go to New York in a boat. Hmm. And finally, Charles talked him into getting into the helicopter, and we took him 3 feet off the ground for about 15 seconds and put him back down, which allowed him to tell his friends, oh, I've been flying. Yes. And he invited us to come into his house. That was middle of the day. And the first thing he said to me was, you're an American. That wasn't very hard to figure out. And he said, your president just put wage and price controls in. That was President Nixon. He said, what does that mean to you? I'm sitting there at age early 30s, talking to the richest man in the world, and he's asking me questions, and it terrified me, but it also flattered the heck out of me. So for the next couple of hours, Paul Getty and I talked about the economy of the United States as much as I knew about it, and wage and price controls. And then he said, would you like to walk around the house and look at some of the art? What could an answer be yes to that? And we did, and it was filled with art. And he said, you know, I'm going to be moving a lot of this to California and your country. And I said, are you really? Who's going to fly it over for you? He said, fly it? No, I'm not going to endanger it in an airplane. I'm going to put it on the surface. And I said, well, it'll take about 2 months to get there after somebody looks it over and decides whether they want to write their name on the pictures or whatever. Why don't you fly it over? He said, well, what if the plane goes down? I said, well, just fly one picture at a time, one painting at a time, mm-hmm. one objet d'art at a time. And he said, well, let's try it. So as a result of that, I ended up being able to supply some of the lift that John Paul Getty needed to start the Getty Museum in California, which is right near where my son now lives. And as you say, being at the right place with the right product sometimes leads you to great things.
I believe you told me that he had a phone in his house?
He had a pay phone in his house.
Yeah, a pay phone.
Yeah.
So if he wanted to make a call, it was on your dime.
That's right.
And yeah. Despite his vast wealth. I love that story.
But, Steve, you know, during the war years, I spent a lot of time at other people's houses because both of my parents were involved in the war pretty much. And I had to take a quarter with me to put in the hot water machine when I went to their house if I wanted to take a bath that night. So John Paul Getty was just conserving a...
I understand.
An old principle, I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the air cargo industry and how that that chapter of your life unfolded and where that took you.
Well,
flying the Getty art to Los Angeles is, you know, no small feat.
Well, we flew a great many things that you wouldn't think went into the air. Race horses, Sean Connery's car from the series, you know, that had all the guns and everything in it. Things like that were everyday business for us. Almost anything that had to be someplace else in the world quickly that had a short shelf life was destined to air cargo. And air cargo was in its infancy. That particular airline was founded, as I said, right after World War II. And it was founded by some people who made a lot of money during the war. And it was sort of staggering along till Mr. Rockefeller got behind it. And it got aircraft that were better suited to doing what he wanted to do. And we got to working in Concord with Boeing, who wanted to do something that would be a huge aircraft that could carry lots of people or lots of weight. I don't want to get too much into the weeds on what goes into flying freight that's different from flying people, but there are some distinct differences. One of the things is that the people usually come back to where they start from. The freight almost never does.
Right.
So flying air cargo is a triangular or more business. I'll give you a quick example of this, and maybe that'll answer your question. One of the things that we got to doing was flying sheep from Australia to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for the migration of the Hajis, who go there every year. I don't know if you know, the Hajis have to go once in their lives to Mecca, and it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, and they try and have some good sheep there for them. So we got involved in that. We also carried Hajis from different places, but we would bring sheep. We could put maybe 400 or 500 sheep into the aircraft that we were operating at that time.
Sort of the way commercial passengers feel today.
Exactly. Yeah. Probably a little bit more roomy. But at any rate, they didn't use the bathroom.
right.
We would bring the sheep to Saudi Arabia, but they wouldn't let us clean the airplane out in Saudi Arabia. And by the time we got there, we had probably 5 tons of sheep droppings. But we found we could sell them as fertilizer in India. So on the way back to pick up another load of sheep, we went to India and made money on the sheep droppings. I know I'm going to be on the radio. I can't call it what I normally do.
And fuel.
And then we could pick up some things from India and take them down to Australia. So we had a triangular business there that was very profitable for all of its legs.
And did this include the dawning of the jet age, I assume?
Well, I certainly went through that. when I started out, the airline was flying Super G Connies, you may remember, with the triple tail.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful,
beautiful airplane.
Yeah,
no cube at all.
Yeah.
Not built to carry big boxes. We went from that into the DC-8s that the McDonnell Douglas company mm-hmm. put together, which were wonderful aircraft, and they had an ability to stretch that aircraft by 37 feet. That was the DC-8-63CF. Took the first ones of those. Great story there, but I'm not going to entertain you with it at the moment. And we're now into the Vietnam era flying that aircraft. And Boeing was not able to stretch the competing aircraft, the
707, yeah,
because of where the tail was and where the empennage hit the ground. If they rotated it with 37 more feet on it, and Douglas was ahead of them for a while. But we knew that wasn't going to last long because we knew Boeing was going to be doing a 47.
Mm-hmm.
So we got together and worked with Boeing on the development of the 747 cargo aircraft. And we did a lot of things to that aircraft that were picked up later. One of the things is that upper lobe that had 20 seats in it. We added that to the original Boeing 747 so that we could fly our crews or anybody else's around on a cargo plane that was loaded with big cargo, they're called pallets, but they're big boxes that IATA prescribed to fit into that cube.
Wow, so that's how the Boeing 747 ended up with an upstairs, I guess you would say.
That was the beginning of the upstairs, that upper lobe.
Mm-hmm.
Then everybody started putting that on, and it got longer and all
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And we then put a side door into it. It didn't have a side cargo door in it. And we had the opening in the front that looked like a great maw of a fish that opened up, and you could load directly into it. And along the line, we also had a fleet of Canada Air CL-44 swing tails. The Canadian Air Force had built this, and it broke in half, literally, so you could load straight into the front and the
right.
back and then put it together again. But it had some old Rolls-Royce engines on it and was slower than Balaam's ass. So that was what ended up over in London flying
right.
down into Africa.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Our guest is Robert A. Neff of Pinehurst. At some point, I believe you tried retirement, and along the way, you became an author. Uber Ollies, that was your first book?
Yes, sir. Well, it was the first one I ever tried to publish.
Let me just share a selection. In less conflicted times, they might never have met, but as Germany lurches headlong toward World War II, many lives are forced to take unexpected turns. While war swirls around them, Dieter, half-Jewish beer hall piano man, and Sophie, daughter of a prominent Wehrmacht general and a Jewish Polish spy, try to insulate themselves from an ugly time in world history by immersing themselves in music. That, my friends, is the tale that is told in a beautiful novel, a novel of love, loyalty, and political intrigue in World War II, published in 2016. The author, Robert A. Neff. That was quite a leap into a whole different world, the literary world, just as recently as just 10 years ago.
Well, I think I told you before that one of my problems when I no longer was in the airline business, I had a little firm in Wall Street for a few years doing underwritings. And when I went for my key man insurance, they said, sir, you've got cancer that we've got to treat. So I gave up working altogether, put myself in the hands of Memorial Sloan Kettering to try and have them work out a five-year survival plan for me. That was 1993. And Dr. Zvi Fuchs, I want his name out there, said, what do you want? I said, I want to plan to get my new son, I had a child when I was 58, to have him get to age 10. And he said, okay. And he came back to me a little while later, and he said, if you'll do what I tell you and submit to the treatments that I'm going to prescribe, I'll get you the 5 years. I'm now in the 33rd year of his five-year plan, and saludos to you, Dr. Fuchs. So at that point, we had moved to Princeton, New Jersey, so that my wife would have her favorite sister-in-law nearby to help her raise that child, which she did very effectively. And, you know, we stayed there until I didn't die. I just kept getting better. And I told you we came down here looking at universities and moved to North Carolina, another very fortuitous event that was unplanned. We've stayed here ever since. I loved it. I love the people that I meet here. But I found that every time I would go to any kind of a gathering, somebody would say, what did you used to do, like when you were alive? And that's kind of discouraging, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends here had read something that I had read. I wrote a lot. Just I enjoyed writing. And I guess they got stored into a desk in our guest room in Princeton. And he must have been a somnambulist who walked around and picked things up and read them. And he said, gee, this is good. And I said, yeah, thank you, John. And my wife said, no, it's not really very good. But anyhow, he talked me into trying to really write something on purpose. And I wrote Über Alles. I wanted to write about World War II, which I thought I knew a lot about. And during my time in both in the Rockefeller's business and then in the airline part, I had many, many employees and friends in Germany, all of whom had been in some aspect of the other side during the war. And I thought, gee, wouldn't it be interesting to write about World War II the way Gone with the Wind wrote about the Civil War, not counting the number of caissons and horses and dead people, but taking normal people that you can affiliate yourself with who aren't interested in the politics of the time and showing how they get embroiled in the war. And so my two protagonists, Sophie and Dieter, who you've described, kind of fall in love with one another. And they're both musicians, and they try to continue that. But because of who her father is and because of the fact that Dieter is a Jewish guy, they eventually end up falling into the war. And they have many adventures. And what I try to do is describe a lot of aspects of the war that you wouldn't normally learn about. One of which is one of the great concentration camps that the Germans had there. And I went to see the movie Nuremberg 2 weeks ago, enjoyed it a lot. And they have a map there that they show all the concentration camps. There were actually about 60 that might qualify for that. But there was one of them outside Prague in a place called Theresienstadt that they decided it was not within Poland, Germany, Austria. It wasn't where they could control visitors. Czechoslovakia, which was in the Sudetenland of Germany, mm-hmm. was enough a part of the world commerce and people were going to go there and see it. So they put all of the musicians that they captured throughout Europe into Theresienstadt, and they gave concerts, and they did Verdi's Requiem, a very difficult piece of music, 13 times. And they had kings and queens and the International Red Cross, and people would go there and say, these people are really happy, you know. So I wanted to, Julie and I went and spent some time at Theresienstadt and verified what I was writing about. But my protagonist, Dieter, ends up being a prisoner in Theresienstadt and escapes from Theresienstadt. And his escape is exactly the escape that one of my German friends had made. He was captured by the American forces, and he got onto a Stennis boat in Lisbon, Portugal, and went to Brazil. This is exactly what my Dieter does. And
So was based on a real person's
even the name
journey.
Of the boat is the same.
So and, so Uber Alles is published in 2016.
Yeah, really, it didn't come out. You know, you get a publication date. It's not the date that you introduce it or anything. Yeah, 2018 was its real hit date.
Okay.
And the American Librarians Association featured it at their annual convention in Chicago. And I went and talked to 20,000 blue-haired ladies who loved it.
And then two more
followed.
And tell us the titles of those and briefly how they sort of follow on from the original.
Well, Uber Alles takes us through to 1945 when my characters have reestablished their relationship with one another. And the same people who liked the first book said to me, you got to write a sequel to this. So I did write After All. And After All is pretty much situated in Latin America. And I wanted to do that because I spent a large part of my life down there. And I was always disappointed in the paucity of knowledge amongst my friends here about anything in Latin America, including my political friends who, you know, didn't know what was going on in there at all. So I wanted to kind of take them through South America. Sophie, who is my female protagonist, is a singer, as you will find out. And she unites with an interesting gentleman who was a band leader friend of mine when I lived down there. And the interesting thing about him was that he came from a very prominent black family in the United States. And they did not approve of his working with Louis Armstrong and playing jazz. And he said, then I'll leave and I'll go down and I'll do it someplace else. And he had the finest band orchestra in Latin America, played in the Copacabana Palace every weekend. And she tours with him on a sort of an artificial tour through South America. And that's how I kind of suck people into South American tourism mm-hmm. and knowledge. And then the final, that takes us up from 1945. I wanted to kind of put a final paragraph together on the whole idea. So I go to 1965, and I start with something called Final Reckoning. It's also got a German title, where all of my characters who are still alive sort of play out what they think they went through and whether what they did was well done or not well done. Über alles itself means above all else. It was part of the German national anthem. Mm-hmm. And I guess at the time they adopted it, it's an old Haydn melody, but they put Deutschland über alles together there, and that was what was supposed to be above everything. And I guess all three of these books really are going to acquaint my readers with what was really important for those people between 1938 and 1965. So I still have got the third book in my laptop ready to publish. Unfortunately, my second book came out just at the same time that COVID did. Mm-hmm. And Julie and I were on our way to Australia, not with sheep droppings, but we were on our way to Australia. And I had a lot of different scheduled appearances and conversations with people, and they all had to be scuttled. And I happened to like After All very well. I think I wrote better by that time. And I wanted to give it a chance to breathe a little bit. But we'll be out in the next couple of months with the third book.
And that's Final Reckoning.
Final Reckoning.
Okay, so that book is yet to come.
Well, it exists on
yes.
My laptop.
It's a completed work.
I've actually got it printed out and on my desk, but there are many steps. When you go around to writing a book, Steve, you'll find out that there are many steps between you thinking of something and somebody else reading it in a form that you want it to be in.
I would say I couldn't really comprehend the process of writing a work of fiction, but it obviously takes tremendous discipline, and obviously you have to be able to develop those plot lines throughout.
Well, let me go back to what you just said. A work of fiction is incredibly less difficult than a work of historical fiction, because historical fiction has got to fit history. Mm-hmm. And almost anybody who can read knows a little bit about history. Mm-hmm. And is challenging you any time you step away from the truth. You can write a book that is totally out of your head, and nobody can say it's not true. People can fly, they can go back in time, they can do all sorts of wonderful things. But if you're going to write historical fiction and include historical characters and events, you've got to be accurate, and that sends you to the library very often. You have to be right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing all these fascinating phases of your life. And we're certainly glad that you found Pinehurst back nearly 20 years ago. And it's great having you living here in this community. And I look forward to continuing our conversation as we go forward.
I share that. And thank you very much for listening to all of my chicken stories and airline stories and other writing stories.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters doing what we do best,
taking aim.